Now, can you hear me okay?
Good old technology goddess. She's got a funny sense of humor. Just want to take a few moments to introduce our guest speaker to you, who I know is familiar to most of you, perhaps. David Loy is a professor, writer, and Zen teacher in the Sambo Kyodan tradition of Zen Buddhism. He's a prolific author whose essays and books have been translated into many languages. David's articles regularly appear in the pages of Buddhist magazines, including Tricycle, Lion's Roar, and Buddha Dharma, as well as in a variety of scholarly journals. His most recent book is Eco Dharma: Buddhist Teachings for the Ecological Crisis. David teaches nationally and internationally on a variety of topics, focusing primarily on the encounter between Buddhism and modernity, what each can learn from the other. He's particularly concerned about social and ecological issues. David, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, David. I'm really delighted to be back again. And let me just start by saying that I really appreciate this opportunity, the fact that I am sort of invited back. This Tuesday night is a kind of very special sort of venue for me, in that I feel so comfortable here, offering talks, like first draft of talks that I've never actually presented before. And that's basically what I want to do tonight, which is one indirect way of saying that I think it's going to be a little rough on the edges again. I want to talk about freedom, share some reflections on freedom from a Buddhist perspective, but it's going to take a little while to get to the Buddhist perspective, but I think you'll that'll so it's going to involve sort of creating a context and understanding sort of the role of the value of freedom in our society. And of course, last week we celebrated July 4th, our Independence Day, which sort of, is one of the main expressions of the incredibly high value. You could say it's even our paramount value that we place on freedom. Maybe our most precious value of all. But the point of my talk is that it's also a complicated and problematical value as well, in a way that I think Buddhism can help us understand it and modify or supplement the way that we often think about freedom. So with that as a kind of preface, let me go ahead and say that I assume I'm not the only one here who's been appalled by a number of recent Supreme Court decisions, overturning Roe versus Wade as one of them, but also the court is limiting the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, how much it can regulate carbon emissions. And also, there was a ruling on handguns. Sort of striking down some state laws that were limiting people's rights to carry guns. And what do they all have in common? It seems to me that, like so many other crucial issues, they're all about freedom, really. So often it comes down to this, like overturning Roe versus Wade. Is a woman, I mean, it's her own body. Is a woman free to abort a pregnancy? Or does a fetus have rights, including the freedom from being aborted, from being terminated, the freedom to develop and be born? Does the EPA have the freedom to regulate carbon emissions? Or are corporations, are factories free to emit as much carbon as they want to? And the case about guns. Does the Second Amendment guarantee that I am free to carry a gun, even something like a semi-automatic? But what about someone else's freedom not to be shot by a gun, or to be free from the fear of being shot by a gun, or the fear of one's child being shot by a gun. I recently saw a very poignant editorial cartoon. It showed two people. You just saw their back, and they're standing in front of a cemetery, a graveyard. And the one person is very old, a very old guy, and next to him is a little kid. And the old guy says, I'm here to pay my respects to my comrades who died at Omaha Beach, during the Normandy invasion. What about you, kid? And the kid says, same. Third grade, second period. Also, what does freedom mean during a pandemic? Am I free not to wear a mask? How does that connect with your freedom not to be infected by me? And your freedom not to be afraid of being infected by me, right? I mean, the individualistic response is, well, you know, that's your problem. But I think this already shows that the issue of freedom is a fraught one. It's a complicated one, right? I've sometimes said that the highest ideal of the Western tradition, Western civilization, has been social justice. But I think in sort of more popular, the way people think about values, I think it would really come down to freedom. Although, of course, social justice, justice and freedom are very deeply connected, of course, right? Often the lack of justice is a reference. It's because there's lack of freedom, as in perhaps the most extreme example, that of slavery, right? The worst form of social injustice, slavery, is because there's a complete denial of the slave's freedom. More generally, the value of freedom, I think, has become so deeply involved in how we understand ourselves that it's actually very difficult to sort of look at it objectively. And yet, it's not something natural. It's something that has a history. In fact, according to some people, like the British historian Lord Acton, the growth of freedom for him is nothing less than kind of at the very heart or the very core of the development of the West. He says, the growth of freedom has been the central theme of history because it represents God's plan for humanity. And certainly we can look at the history of Western civilization as a story of the development of freedom as an ideal, at least, even if it's not always been actualized. So one of the sources or origins of Western civ, we trace it back to Greece, because there was a kind of emancipation there in classical Greece of rationality from myth. But more recently, there was the Reformation, which was really all about religious freedom. Then there was political freedom. You think about English, American, French revolutions. Economic freedom, you think about the class struggle, Marxism, unions. And more recently, we could say psychological freedom, psychotherapy frees us from neuroses. And most recently, gender freedom, sexual freedom, feminism, gay rights, gay marriage, emancipation of women, sexual deviance, and most recently, transgender issues. So I guess it's not a surprise that freedom does seem to be the paramount value, not only I think in the US, but really in the larger Western world or modern world generally. As Orlando Patterson, one scholar, says, people may sin against freedom, but no one dares deny its virtue. Nonetheless, as important as this Western history has been for the development of our personal freedom, I think it also sort of points to the roots of the problems that haunt us today, especially the extreme individualism that has, you could say, liberated greed as the sort of engine of economic development. There I'm making a pretty strong statement. But the kind of individualism that I think has undeniably tended to erode community bonds, community relationships, right? But you think about, I mean, think what happened with those political revolutions that I mentioned a while ago. The French had a revolution where they got rid of their king, and what did they end up with? Well, they ended up with Napoleon. The Russians had a revolution. What did they end up with? They ended up with Stalin. The Chinese had a revolution, and what happened? Well, basically Mao Zedong replaced the emperor. So all of these top-down dictatorships sort of vindicating that famous statement by the British guy, Edmund Burke, that the sudden disintegration doesn't, such as happens often with revolutions, it doesn't necessarily need lead to real freedom, just another version of oppression. Part of the problem here, I think, is that the concept of freedom is very elusive because there's something incomplete about it, which makes it very difficult to define. The abstract concept sort of loses meaning outside particular contexts, right? There's freedom from, there's freedom to. One definition distinguishes three types of freedom. There's freedom, personal freedom, being able, you and me being able to do what we want within the limits of others' desire, right? It's like, I'm free to swing my arm, but that ends where your jaw begins, that kind of thing. That's one kind of freedom, where we limit each other, but we're free within that context. There's also what's called sovereignal, don't know how you say it, which is basically the power that someone might have to act in whatever way they want to without having to restrain themselves. So it's the power of an absolute dictator or a king to do whatever they want to us. And then finally, there's civic freedom, the capacity of members of a community to participate in their own governance, right? In other words, what we call democracy. We decide together how we live. But here's the point, and this is where Buddhism comes in. Do we need a fourth kind of freedom in addition to these three, what, the personal, the sovereignal, the civic? And that's basically what I'm going to be arguing for. Once we realize more clearly the problems, and again, I think these are problems that are really facing us today, why this is such an important issue. But once we realize the problems here, then I think we'll see the need for the kind of freedom that Buddhism emphasizes. Basically, I think my argument is going to be something like, making freedom into our paramount value is dangerous, especially if we conceive of it in solely in political terms. It's basically flawed because it can't give us what we really seek from it. And basically what I want to make is three points. First of all, connecting freedom with our extreme individualism, right? Way back in 1928, Herbert Hoover invoked the American system of rugged individualism, and that term still lasts. The idea that it's a place of, that this country is a place of free markets, individual thought, and skepticism about any conformity. But the basic point here is that I think any culture that emphasizes individuality or individualism to the extent that the United States does is kind of inevitably going to place very high value, if not the highest value of all, on the freedom of that individual self, right? But this is where it gets interesting from a Buddhist perspective, because as we know, one of the essential claims of Buddhism is interdependence, including the denial that there's such a thing as a separate self. So what does it mean to be focused on the individual, on the freedom of a self, of a separate self, that according to Buddhism doesn't really exist, right? And that leads to the second point, which is that if the self-existence of that separate self, if the autonomy of that separate self is an illusion, then such a self will never be able to experience itself as free enough. If that self, as I think so often happens here, and I think this is really important for understanding, you know, some of the culture wars we have now, if the focus is on, you know, me being an individual, me being free, the question is, can that self ever feel free enough if it doesn't have any real self-existence, as Buddhism has to say? And so that will lead to the third point, this new dimension, that it's not simply a matter of freedom for the self, but what Buddhism really implies is something like freedom from the self, freedom from the ego self, as often understood, as often experienced, which can be understood as the goal of Buddhism, and indeed not only Buddhism, but if we think about all other Indian religions, the emphasis on moksha, liberation, right? Freedom from samsara, freedom from suffering, freedom from delusion, especially the delusion of a separate ego, right? For Buddhism, the sense of self is not some kind of self-existing consciousness, pure consciousness, but just to unpack it a little bit, in contemporary terms, the sense of self is a psychological and social construct. It's the way that mostly habitual ways of thinking and feeling and acting and reacting tend to sort of work together to give us the sense of separation, the sense that there's a me inside that's separate from the rest of the world outside, right? And the basic issue here is that because this sense of self is a construct, because it doesn't have any reality, any existence of its own, such a self is inherently insecure, inherently uncomfortable. One way to say it is, it's not going to fit, experience itself as real enough. Another way to say it, which I tend to use more often, is that this sense of self will feel that there's some kind of lack. By lack here, I mean the sense that something isn't quite right with me, something is wrong, something is missing in my life, something is missing in me, I'm not good enough. And the question is, does this help us understand the way that we sometimes think about freedom and some of the problems that occur when we want to absolutize our freedom, right? What I've more often talked about in the past, those of you who have heard my talks, I'm afraid you've, and apologies for repeating myself here, but I've often talked about the sense of self's sense of lack in terms of we tend to externalize it. We tend to objectify, like there's a feeling something lacking. What, it's something out here that I'm lacking, right? Conditioned often by society in one form or other. So very common in our society, it's the notion, okay, I don't have enough money. Now there may be cases when, there's plenty of cases when one might really not have enough money. But the point here is that this as a lack project, this, we have this need. We understand the problem with my life is that I don't have enough money, and the solution, therefore, is to get more money. And the tragedy here is because this understanding that the fundamental lack in my life is that I don't have enough money, because that's really just a symptom of a deeper issue, this lack of self-existence, because it's a symptom of this deeper issue, it means that it doesn't matter how much money I'm able to get, I'll never have enough to fill up this sort of bottomless pit at the core of my being. So that's maybe the most common example that I'm citing. Other ones are things like fame, especially in our sort of screen preoccupied digital culture. I think fame is often a way we think of that that'll make us feel more real if I'm just more famous, more successful in that sense. Or, you know, romantic relationships, if I just find that perfect partner who will sort of complete me, fill me, then everything will be okay. So those are the kind of standard examples that I'm often referring to. But what I'm really thinking about today and wanting to add to that, especially in light of the kind of culture wars that we're in now, is can we understand freedom also as another version of a lack project that people don't feel that they are free enough? I don't know if it's necessary to emphasize just how extreme our individualism is in this culture. It seems to me that, how to say it, I'm not aware that there has been any more individualistic culture in human history to the point where I think we often have problems with community. And even basic things like friendship. Here I'm reminded of a story that David Chernikoff has told about his experience in Nepal, which just highlights the implications of this extreme individualism for how it often and so often involves isolation, loneliness. Dave, I don't think you'll mind me telling this story, David, but you were telling somebody in Nepal about how people about your job as a psychotherapist and the people you were talking to. I assume they were, rural people in Nepal, and they weren't so familiar with the idea of psychotherapy, and they paused for a while, and then they asked you, but don't they have any friends? The idea that one would need to talk to a psychotherapist, surely if you have problems, you would just talk to your friends. And the irony of this, of course, is that what's happened in contemporary America is that actually many people don't have friends, especially men. I read some study recently that, if I remember it correctly, it was saying how the average man has less than one close friend that they can sort of really talk with intimate things about. Less than one. In other words, there are many people who don't have any close friends at all. And of course, I think it's much more common with men than with women. So this sense of isolation and individualism, I think it's easy then to see how this could translate into a focus on the freedom, our individual freedom to be able to do what we want. I remember reading recently somebody who said, all billionaires are libertarians. They just want to be left alone to spend their money. I don't know if that's true, but it makes sense. So this larger question of if the self-existence and autonomy of the sense of self is an illusion, as Buddhism claims, then I think it makes sense, a lot of sense, to say that that self will never be able to experience itself as enough of itself, will never be able to feel that it's free enough, and it'll just like if I understand my problem is I don't have enough money, I need to get more money. So if you think that you're not free enough, that you're constrained by something outside, then you're going to need, you're going to understand the problem as the need for more freedom. I appreciate I'm repeating myself here. That's the disorganization of this talk. But I also wonder how much does this, well, let me approach it this way. Referring to something that I've been studying a lot recently, evolutionary psychology, right? I think evolutionary psychology, when you understand about the competition to not only to survive, but to have offspring, to raise offspring, I think that can help us understand some of the negative things that Buddhism talks about, like the three poisons, greed, ill will, delusion. That, sometimes being greedy, sometimes being violent, aggressive, sometimes, just looking out for number one, that could maybe serve, make it more likely that you're going to live, make it more likely that your offspring will, that you'll have offspring and they will be able to live and reproduce. So there's a tendency here, to promote sometimes some sort of negative, self-absorbed, self-preoccupied, right? What's in it for me? What's good for me? What's going to help me reproduce? But it's not only issues of individual freedom, it's also you have to deal with other groups. Like you're part of a group, and it's really important that people in your group work together in order to avoid being defeated or overrun or killed by another group that might be competing for the same kind of resources. In other words, if people are simply thinking about their own, what's good for them individually, if you have a group of individuals who only care about that, they're more likely to be defeated by a group that really works together well, that's able to sort of overcome a certain kind of self-preoccupation temporarily in order to fight against. So in the way that it's expressed in evolutionary psychology is there's individual selection, right? What's good for me? And there's group selection, what's good for the group. But here's the interesting thing. What holds the group together? What keeps people working together rather than simply becoming a group of separate individuals? What makes people willing to sort of sacrifice a little bit of their freedom, a little bit of their self-interest? Well, in evolutionary terms, we can see it's that other group over there. It's that other group outside. It's that other group outside ourselves that's a threat to us, that's competing with us, that's dangerous. That's what tends to hold the group together. And what happens though if that group isn't there anymore? Well, the tendency is then is for our group to sort of dissipate, to fall apart, and to emphasize my own personal freedom again. And the reason I mention this, I think we have quite a strong example of it with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the communist bloc generally, right? All the time that the United States and Western Europe felt threatened by the Soviet Union, we needed to stay together, right? You think of NATO and so forth. But what happened when the Soviet Union collapsed? I remember reading right at that time a Soviet diplomat saying, quote, "We are going to do something terrible to you." Right? We, the Soviets, are going to do something terrible to you Americans. We are going to deprive you of an enemy. Wow. And notice the historical timing. Right after that, very soon after that, what happened? Well, we got Newt Gingrich, the contract with America. Basically, we got the real beginnings, I think, of the culture wars. At that point, the enemy wasn't out there in the same way. And so we tended more to bickering. The Republicans and the Democrats didn't have to work together. And the sort of compromises that were necessary before, people didn't need to be so concerned about that. Internal strife increased, right? Or another way to say it, there was still a problem, but now the problem was internal. The problem was leftist groups. The problem was, for the Republicans, the problems was the Democrats, who want to raise taxes. The problem, was that, well, as one person said, this is what I heard, we need semi-automatics. People have to have semi-automatic guns because the government has them and because we might need to fight against the government. And I read some recent statistic lately. I wish I could remember the details, but a significant number of people, a quarter or a third of Republicans, or maybe not just Republicans, talking about how we might need to take up arms against our government, right? So I'm offering all of that as an example of what happened when the external enemy wasn't there. And now, as long as we had the Soviet Union, we had the problem, the threat to our freedom, why we didn't have as much freedom as we thought we should have was out there. Once that is gone, then now the problem is internal, right? The problem is we have to make America great again, right? Does this make any sense? I hope so. If we understand the dynamic here, if we understand that as an example of how, you know, freedom can become really problematical, then I think we can see how we need to re-examine freedom from a new perspective. And I think the ecological crisis, which threatens our survival, is something that really also pushes us in that direction. It's interesting how the ecological crisis cannot be understood in terms of our need for greater freedom. On the contrary, it's really kind of the opposite, in the sense that freedom in this case, I think we can see, is the problem, insofar as we have been, we as a species have sort of enlarged our kind of sovereignal freedom to sort of do whatever we can to the earth in our quest, our collective quest for ever greater wealth and comfort and so forth, right? You can say our humanistic domination of nature, you could almost understand that as a kind of totalitarian relationship, but a good example of that sovereignal freedom that I mentioned, where basically we can do whatever we want to the earth. We can exploit it, we can despoil it, we can pollute it. I think the ecological crisis basically points to the fact that this freedom that we've had in our relationship to the natural world, as opposed to feeling bonded, as opposed to feeling a responsibility, as opposed to feeling a sense of communion, kind of like, I don't know, like a marriage, in the sense that there's a relationship where, you know, there are expectations, but there's responsibilities, the sense that we might have responsibilities to the earth, to cherish it, to take care of it. I think it's clear that this too is another problematical form of freedom, that up to this point we felt completely free in terms of what we want to do to the earth. The earth had to put up with it because of our power. And I think the ecological crisis is another symptom of this problem with our preoccupation with freedom, freedom in this sense of, you know, so that we can do whatever it is that we want to do. As some people have said, maybe what we need today isn't the Declaration of Independence, but the Declaration of Interdependence, by tempering our understanding of freedom, that the idea of complete freedom is an illusion too dangerous to tolerate anymore. So basically what I'm trying to say here, what I'm talking around here, is that the emphasis of the modern West, and I think we see the best example of this in our country, the US, it's been on individual freedom from oppressive institutions. The prime example being, right, the Bill of Rights appended to our Constitution. And that's been so important. But the emphasis in Buddhism and other Asian traditions, especially in India, has been on what we might call psychological freedom or spiritual freedom, right? So tempering our preoccupation with freedom for the self, right, freedom from external determination, freedom from external control, with an emphasis on freedom from the self, or from the ego self, freedom from the delusion of a separate self. And I think today we can see the importance of both types of freedom. Here I'm reminded of that famous statement by Gary Snyder in his essay on anarchism, right? The mercy of the West has been social revolution. The mercy of the East has been individual insight into the basic self, the emptiness of the self. He says, we need both. Well, that can be understood in terms of freedom, right? Social revolution that he refers to as the great mercy, or the great contribution of the West, freedom from the kind of external control that manipulates us and uses us for someone else's purposes, the freedom that enables us to be self-determining what we value, what we pursue, what we want to do. But how that in and of itself is insufficient and dangerous unless we also understand it from the Buddhist side, right? The freedom from the three poisons, freedom from my own greed, freedom from my own ill will, freedom from my own delusion, especially the delusion of a separate self. The basic point here being that we need to actualize both ideals to have a really meaningful freedom, that just one or the other by itself is going to be insufficient. And again, the Buddhist ideal of freedom, that, you know, I've talked a lot about the other freedom, the problems with social freedom, Western conceptions of freedom, but it also works on the other side. And if you think of somewhere like Burma, Myanmar, you might have a very enlightened, very spiritually mature Buddhist monastic, but even if that person has done a great job dealing with their own greed, ill will, delusion, they're still living in a very oppressive society. So to reinforce what Gary Snyder said, we need both. We need both types of freedom. Earlier, I quoted Lord Acton. And there's another quote here I think is very apt. He says, "Liberty is not the power to do what we like, but being able to do what we ought to do." The freedom to do what we ought to do. All of this reminds me of one of my favorite quotations, a very long one, but very powerful, very meaningful one, by David Foster Wallace. And I've quoted it a number of times talking about it in terms of LAC projects, but you can also understand his focus in terms of freedom, why it is that we're not usually as free as we think we are, how often the unfreedom is something unconscious. And basically his quotation is really about why we're not free and what genuine freedom is about. It's from a commencement address that he once gave. Yeah, it's really about what freedom means and what keeps us, what makes us unfree. Quote, "In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's no such thing as atheism. No such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing, be it Jesus Christ or Allah, Yahweh, or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or something, is that pretty much anything else you worship is going to eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you'll never have enough. Never feel you have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you'll always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before you actually get buried. Worship power, you'll feel weak and afraid, and you'll need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out." All of these are lack projects that we never have enough. And the whole point of my talk this evening is to suggest that a certain type of preoccupation with freedom, my own individual freedom, which should not be restricted, that can be another version of it, a version, right? That we're never going to be able to feel enough if that's what we worship. The insidious thing about these forms of worship isn't that they're evil or sinful, it's that they're unconscious, Wallace says. They're default settings, default, unconscious. Another word for that is unfree. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value, without ever being fully aware that's what you're doing. And the world won't discourage you from that, because the world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and the worship of self. And then he goes in to talk about freedom. The really important kind of freedom, he says, involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad little petty, unsexy ways every day. That's real freedom. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. That's a beautiful, much better than I could ever express it, which is why I quoted a lot. That's just a beautiful expression of lack projects, and how freedom can become a trap. I'd like to conclude with another quotation, this one quite short, by the German writer Goethe. Quite striking. He says, two lines, "You have only to think of yourself as free to feel bound. You have only to think of yourself as bound to feel free." Now, what's he saying here? Huh? I don't know the context, but it evokes, I think, something very, very powerful. Let me read it again. If you think of yourself as free, if you think of yourself as free, you're going to feel bound, right? But if you think of yourself as bound, then you are free. What's going on here? Well, there are two things that this evokes for me. One of them is this old dialect, dialect, I guess is the word, between freedom and security, how it is that these are two sort of human drives. I think they're very deep within us, that when we don't feel free enough, you know, we seek more freedom. But when we get freedom, often the other side of freedom is a kind of insecurity. That's why we're free. And then we want the security and this tendency to kind of bounce back and forth between them. I think for many people, this becomes their whole lives. I don't know, maybe one example, people who keep marrying and divorcing over and over again. Maybe that's too obvious an example. But there's something else here that I think this evokes, at least in me. And again, I don't know the context, but this suggests this other point, which I'll finish with. To be completely free would be to be completely sort of separate, right? As I was saying earlier, to be individualistic, to be lonely, I think, that total freedom, that total loss of bonds, right? Is that the sense in which there's a kind of restriction? You know, thinking about it in Buddhist terms, in terms of the dukkha, the suffering of that isolation, you know, you might be free, but a horrible kind of freedom. Well, there's no relationship with other living beings, with other human beings. On the other side, to feel bound, and what bounds us or bonds us more than love. When that is the bond that connects us, right? When we feel bound in that way, are we free? In the sense that, seems to me we are, in the sense that we want to do whatever we can naturally. We want to do whatever we can to take care of, to cherish those whom we love. And it feels like freedom, because that's what we naturally want to do. And I just, you know, as a way of concluding, I wonder more and more if that's the kind of freedom that we really need to be moving toward, given the kind of crises that, you know, we're facing today in relationship to the earth, for example, if we sort of look at it in terms of the ecological crisis. Obviously, there's going to be some pretty important restrictions in terms of consumption, I think, If we're going to heal the relationship between ourselves and the earth. At the same time, if the motivation behind all that is love, is a sense of love for the earth, love for Mother Earth, a sense of belonging and meaning, you know, so there are the bounds there in terms of, you know, we can see the physical constraints and so forth. But if we experience those as love, then I think we will experience what we do to heal the earth and to heal our relationship with the earth as something that we do freely. So let me stop there and hope that those reflections made some sense. Thank you for your attention.
David, do you want to invite comments or questions or reflections from folks?
For sure. Yeah, very happy to do that.
Okay, great. If you'd like to make a comment, you could do that in a couple of ways. One would be to use the reactions button and hit the raise hand symbol. Another would be to put something in the chat, which I could read out to the group. I see one hand up. Would you go ahead and unmute, please?
Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, David and David.
Hi, Andrew.
Claire, nice to see you. David, thank you so much for, as usual, a very provocative presentation. But I wanted to actually ask a question and maybe share a couple of things about an angle that I've always found very compelling, which is this notion of escape from freedom. Eric Fromm wrote a book by that title, Dostoevsky, and this is, I want to read a short quote from the chapter, The Brothers Karamazov, and then maybe tie this in briefly to a spiritual interjection that may be worth tossing about. But this is one of the haunting lines from the fifth chapter, I think it's chapter five, Dostoevsky. I tell you that man has no more tormenting care than to find someone to whom he can hand over as quickly as possible that gift of freedom with which the miserable creatures But he alone can take over the freedom of men who appeases their conscience. There's nothing more seductive for man than freedom of his conscience, but there's nothing more tormenting either. Amazing quote from a political perspective. And here's one from a real rabble-rouser, Trungpa Rinpoche, where this now can be extended, I think, into a spiritual domain, where he says this: if everything is open, totally open, deadly spacious, that is extremely threatening, end quote. So I think on one level, this is what I want to pass your direction. On one level, it seems like we're in this double bind where on one level, developmentally, perhaps we want freedom more than anything else, but on another level, perhaps we fear it more than anything else. And maybe this puts us in a kind of bipolar relationship to freedom, conflict of interest. And so I think centrifuging out everything that you said, perhaps with throwing this into the works, to me makes this issue even more provocative, let alone the topic that's well beyond the scope, the whole notion of free will altogether and possible. But maybe we don't need to go there. So anyway, just kind of escape from freedom from both political and also spiritual points of view.
Right.
Seriously, if
you have thank you, Andrew. Yeah, am I interrupting?
No.
Yeah, great. Yeah, no, thank you. I love that quotation from Dostoevsky, in particular, and I think he's right. And in a way, I kind of alluded to it, but I really didn't have time to get into it. This dialectic of freedom and security. There's something terrifying about freedom, right? And that's what they're pointing to. And you know, I don't know whether we want to compare it with long childhood and being taken care of and parental figures and authority figures. I think that tends to, here's the way it seems to me, that dialectic is applying to the usual sense of self that we have, the usual sense of separate self. And in my lack terms, right, where we tend to be preoccupied trying to make ourselves feel more real, and that's another way of talking about security, another way of sort of giving ourselves some substantiality. And so you could understand this in terms of like a kind of self-grounding. But here's the point, it seems to me, that to let go of oneself, such as we talk about, say, in the Zen tradition, Dogen, right, to forget yourself, to let go of yourself for the bottom to fall out of the bottom of the bucket, is to realize a different kind of belonging, a different kind of security. So it's like the ego self can never secure itself wholly, fully. That's the fundamental problem. But by letting go of itself, it can realize that it's grounded in the whole, that it's always been completely secured in the sense of being a manifestation of something greater than itself. Or we can talk about it in terms of the earth. I mean, and so what I see that as pointing to is the importance, maybe the inescapability of bringing in the spiritual understanding of freedom as well, of freedom beyond ego. Because on the level of ego, I think what you're pointing to can't be escaped. I think that's where we're trapped. And the wonderful thing about something like Buddhism is that it shows us a way out of that trap. So does that make sense? I didn't know if you wanted to back on that one.
It's great. I think it's great. And to me, I think it just has a lot of explanatory power for those of us perhaps conjecturing that this may be one reason, not turning it into the purely spiritual domain, why we may be half-hearted on the spiritual path, because in the spectrum of our identity, we are terrified of that which we most desperately seek. Mm-hmm. I think it's a kind of dissonance that creates so much of the rub. And it's interesting in Tibetan, the word for renunciation, nunje, is definite emergence. Definitively, not partially, remove your almost exclusive identification to that bandwidth of identity we know as the ego. And so for me, this is a wonderfully complex, compelling topic where the only, perhaps one of the best ways to reconcile proposed answers to this is understanding actually the spectrum of our identity, that there is part of us, this kind of ultraviolet higher dimension of our being, the frequency that really longs for freedom, enlightenment, whatever you want to call it, more than anything else. And then you have the devolutionary end, the tail that continues to wag the dog, that is terrified of this. And hence somewhere in between, if we don't understand that friction, then this is why there's such an attrition, I think, psychologically, this undercurrent of lack of renunciation born of this kind of internal divisiveness. So anyway, just some noodles to throw
again. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. You know, this fundamental problem, the ego self wants to be enlightened. Well, it can't be. That's the problem. It doesn't work like that. You know, the ego self has to let go. It has to die, forget itself. And oh, that's a different ball game. Yeah. Sorry. Sorry, David. We went on a bit there.
Oh, that's fine.
Master of the one-liner, Trungpa Rinpoche said, you know, ego cannot attend its own funeral. So
but it wants to. Yeah. I want to hear all the nice things people I'm hoping will say about me when I die. Right.
Please, let's go ahead with the next person, Piero.
Thank you, David, or both Davids, actually. David for hosting and David for the talk. Andrew said it's a very complex and compelling subject, and I subscribe to this. I see myself, and probably it's interesting that we're talking about the self and I bring myself. I want to be free, but I catch myself wanting to limit other people's irresponsible freedom. And what came to me while you were talking, I sent you a short message saying that I'm Brazilian and I didn't have I was under, I grew up under military rule in Brazil, where the military was in charge of the federal government. And I only had the right to vote for president of my country when I was 36 years old. And I found this terrible. I mean, you know, that I couldn't exercise my right to vote. I was limited in so many ways. So what came to me, and I'm not sure if you are aware of this quote. I'm going to put the quote from Viktor Frankl, and I'm not even sure if this is his quote, and I'll read this. I put it on the chat. I got this quote from a site that is trying to promote the construction of the Statue of Responsibility. So I Google statue, you can Google Statue of Responsibility, and this quote comes up. Freedom is in danger of Freedom is the danger of degenerating into mere arbitrariness unless it is lived in terms of responsibleness. That is why I recommend that the Statue of Liberty on the East Coast be supplemented by a Statue of Responsibility on the West Coast, Viktor E. Frankl. I want to limit the irresponsible liberty of others. That's my feeling. I want to limit the freedom of speech of the people in Fox News, for instance. I want to limit the irresponsible drive for power of authoritarians out there. Andrew, again, it's a very complex and compelling subject. For me, it's almost 11 p.m. here in the East Coast, so I'm not being able to articulate this very, I'm articulating this poorly, but perhaps this is my main preoccupation. Mm-hmm. Freedom mm-hmm. and responsibility in the exercise of freedom.
I agree with that completely, and you're bringing out some of the nuances, some of the complications that are involved with that. Yeah, thank you, Piero. Yeah.
Mm. We've got time for one more brief comment. And Barry, I see you've got a hand up. Would you go ahead and unmute, and please keep it on the brief side if you can.
First of all, Piero just stole my thunder about freedom and responsibility. Though I wanted to put it in terms of when we think of freedom, we think of the I see over and over again people saying, "I have my rights." Like it's my I have a right to own an AK-47, blah 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 blah, or whatever their rights are. And they don't. When I grew up, when I was a kid, I owned a rifle and a shotgun by the time I was 14. But I understood, because my father taught me, that there was a responsibility that went along with owning that rifle and shotgun. You always stored it unloaded. You never pointed it at anybody, even in fun. I mean, there's things you just didn't do. And so that, like, there was the right, I had the right to own this thing and go and hunt with my dad and those things we did, but I also had the responsibility to handle it correctly and safely and store it properly and all those sorts of things. And it's that, I think what's happened is the idea that rights come coupled with responsibilities. That's what's disappeared in our culture. And that's why, that's my rant.
Yeah, thank you for that, Barry. And of course, I agree completely. Another way of talking about the responsibility is accepting the limitations built into using that right wisely so that it doesn't impinge on others. Right. Thank you.
Yeah. David, do you have any closing remark, or do you want to do a dedication, or would you like me to do that? What would be best?
As usual, David, I'm very happy if you do the dedication, in large part because you do it so well. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I have anything more to add to what I said, but thank you all for your attention and your tolerance of my sort of trying to think through some of these issues here.
Yeah. I think you've given us all some really good food for thought, no question about it, given the state of our planet right now. Let's just take a moment together to dedicate the merit and to recognize the good fortune we share in simply being able to come together this way. You can trust, you can let go of some of the concepts and ideas if you'd like, and trust that they'll be available to you if and when they're appropriate and useful for you in terms of right action or right speech. Let's take a nice deep breath into our heart centers, where that the separate self that David talked about tends to dissolve, and where we can actually have a felt sense of our interconnectedness. And let's just rest in our hearts for a few moments and be with what is as it is right now. I'll close with the words of Thich Nhat Hanh. Studying the teachings, practicing the way of awareness, gives rise to benefits without limit. We vow to share the fruits with all beings. We vow to offer tribute to parents, teachers, friends, and numerous beings who give guidance and support along the path. May it be so.
Thank you, David, for making this possible.
So welcome. As is our custom, if any of you feel inclined to unmute and greet a friend or say a word or two to help bring our evening to a close, please feel free to do that. And don't feel obligated, but if you'd like to make a little mindful and joyful noise together, we have a few moments to do that.
Thank you both. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
When I saw the talk of this talk, I thought of one of my favorite philosophers, Janis Joplin, who said, "Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose." I thought you could fit that in your talk someplace.
Oh, that's great. It definitely applies to the practice, right?
Yeah, I think it's actually a very wise statement.
Yeah. David, there's a thank you in the chat for you from Meredith. And to everyone?
I think it's to both of us, David.
Ah.
Maybe to everyone. Thank you, Meredith.
Thank you all. Thank you all.
That's great.
Be well.
Thank you so much. Good night, you all.
Thank you from us both.
Oh, good night to both of you. Take good care.
You too.
There's a thank you from Lynn in the chat as well, David. Everybody take good care, stay healthy, and I'm going to go ahead and close the meeting for now.
Good night. Be well.
David, I'll be in touch, huh? All right.
Thank you.